I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, lordsofpain.net. Wherever you may be listening, Doc says.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast, Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment and of the doctor's orders on lordsofpain.net. Doc says. Hello and welcome to the Doc Says on the Chair Shot Radio Network. I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, author of the greatest matches and rivalries of the WrestleMania era, now available on audiobook format. Just check out the link at the bottom of this page and you will see where you can purchase it. And if you want, send me a message and I will potentially have a promo code for you. So today, it's going to be a little bit longer show. I know there's a lot of wrestling podcasts out there covering a lot of really interesting stuff week to week. So thank you for making me a part of your day. We're going to do a lengthier podcast again because I want to give the WWE Decade in Review series the time I feel like it deserves. It's been a fascinating decade as a WWE fan, but at the same time, I want to give plenty of time to the alternatives to WWE who have risen up in part because of the things we're going to discuss as we advance through the Decade in Review series specific to WWE. So later in the show, much like last week's format, we'll talk about WWE in 2015. But first, I want to take a closer look at All Elite Wrestling. Last week, we had a broader discussion about changing habits. And I think that's one of the things that most people want to see from a wrestling company that they invest their time in, particularly in its week-to-week television format, is they want to see a major pro wrestling promotion on a station they can expect to see them on for the foreseeable future. Unlike Impact, which has changed homes so many times, you hope that Access TV becomes a stable place for them. But you want to see a company like AEW change some of the habits that a lot of people have felt for a long time. WWE has just really struggled to get right. Things like the value of championships, things like tag team wrestling, things like writing simpler, coherent, long-term stories. Things like putting emphasis on stars of today and just making stars of yesterday more background noise or have very specific roles that they fulfill, and then once their story arcs are over and done with, moving them into different roles, not hanging on to the past for hanging on to the past's sake, so to speak, but really actively trying to give as many people as possible an opportunity to create the kind of legacies like I talked about a couple of weeks ago with Ray Cash on this show, like Shawn Michaels was able to build, like as I was talking about recently on social media with several good pro wrestling fan friends of mine, about people like Sting's legacy, Randy Orton's legacy. I mean, guys like that, even if you don't think that they, in Orton's case, reached their full potential as a wrestling superstar, you cannot deny the resume that the guy has and the legacy that he's created for himself and that he's still creating for himself. You feel like it would be hard for somebody in WWE today to equal what Randy Orton has accomplished these past nearly 20 years. And it's not fun to say that. And you hope that there are people out there at the head of these wrestling organizations like All Elite Wrestling where they are fully aware of that, because some of them, like Cody Rhodes, was a victim of the system that prevented him from maximizing what he could get out of his career despite having all the potential in the world to achieve things like he has achieved since he left. But, at the same time, companies like AEW, the product they're putting out week to week, building up to their pay-per-view Full Gear, which I will preview next week on also a little bit of a longer show because of the fact that I want to share with you my live in-person experience. I will be live at All Elite Wrestling in Charlotte next next Wednesday. So I'm really excited to be a part of that. And I want to share with you what it's like to be in that environment in ways that, you know, as a longtime veteran of wrestling shows, I'm anxious to see something unique. I'm anxious to get a different kind of experience. I got a unique experience earlier this year when I went to the NWA pay-per-view, the Crockett Cup. But, you know, at the same time, that still felt very small. I want to feel the bigness of AEW filling an arena that, if I'm not mistaken, used to be called the Independence Arena and was the site of Starrcade 1994 when Vader and Ric Flair collided for career versus championship. I want to be a part of something that feels bigger. It doesn't have to feel big as WWE, but I want it to feel bigger than what I've seen when I've gone to shows that weren't WWE wrestling promoted. So, WWE being what it is, obviously there's a lot of chatter about how people who are very much ready for a company like All Elite Wrestling to hit it out of the park and rise up to be able to challenge WWE at the very least for, if not the full monetary comparison, which I don't think is fair at this point, to at least, you know, take a lot of WWE's market share in terms of the attention that they get, in terms of the amount of social media content that they produce, speaking specifically of fan content, how much attention is paid to what AEW is doing, regardless of whether or not WWE is doing something right or doing something perceived to be wrong. So AEW, we all want it to succeed. To the extent that it succeeds is a bigger question for later, but you know, WWE gets the lion's share of the criticism on the internet, and partly that's because they're the biggest company, partly because that spotlight that they occupy, that a lot of people feel like they don't do a good enough job taking advantage of it. I certainly would fall into that category with my modern feelings, as you are aware. But AEW is not immune to analysis. They're not immune to criticism. They're not immune to any of that. So I thought I would take a little bit of time today to give you a fair analysis of where I feel like they're at right now. This is a report card, if you will, for their first month of television. I want to build on the discussion that I think is the primary thing to look at closely with them to determine their success with it that I mentioned last week, and that's the women's division. I want to start there and I want to build on that conversation. Last week, I pretty much just made clear that I felt like if you look at the women's division right now, it's just not strong enough. It's putting people in places that maybe they will in time prove that they deserve to be there. Maybe in time they will prove that they can maximize a division, that they can be the catalyst for that being a very strong division that people think very highly of. But I personally am not of the opinion that AEW has reached that point with their current crop. I mentioned Impact Wrestling as a comparison. I will read you some of the names that I didn't get around to last week that I've seen in limited spot duty, much like I've seen in limited spot duty of the AEW group, but who I feel have maximized their positions on various Impact Wrestling cards better than have their AEW counterparts. Jessica Havoc, Jordan Grace, Roseberry and Sue Young. Those are names in addition to Tessa Blanchard, Tennille Dashwood, Taya Valkyrie. And when you compare that list of females to AEW's, the ones we've seen most actively utilized thus far, the likes of Bea Priestley, Britt Baker, Nyla Rose, Riho, those have thus far been the most prominent females utilized on AEW's primary television show to date. And that's a good group of females who have done very well. And it is not lost on me that, and I would potentially agree with this if I thought more about it, but I had not until today gotten into the mode of judging a lot of the matches that AEW has produced against each other, but it has not escaped me that some of the podcasters whose opinions I value most, like the guys from the This Is Awesome podcast, who do a tremendous job tapping right into my brain, which loves to break down and analyze pro wrestling matches. I wrote a freaking book on it in WWE history. So those guys, they named the women's match the match of the night, the clear match of the night, the consensus among the three of them, hosting the pod right after AEW's first show. The women's match was the best match on the card that night. A very important night that crowned the first AEW women's champion. And, you know, frankly, I think that if I looked at it a little bit further, I might tend to agree, because I think at the very least the stakes rose to the occasion. The match that they had was a great story told that peaked at the right moment and was a very, by the end of it, a pretty cathartic victory for Riho. But week to week, that is not going to be something that you can equal. Week to week, you have to build character, and I don't think that they're doing a very good job of building characters in that division yet. And a lot of those women don't have the reputation to bank on. They don't have the accessibility of their library of work that a Kenny Omega has, that a Jon Moxley has, that a Pac has. They don't have the ability to even get to the level of the likes of Adam Page or MJF. Their work, at least to me, and I think a lot of the people that listen to this podcast, it's kind of foreign to most of us. So I think collectively we need to see further development of the characters in the women's division, because we're largely unfamiliar with them. And WWE has gotten into this really bad habit of taking an incredible women's roster and underutilizing it. Well, if that's going to be one of the things AEW hangs its hat on, is trying to do things that WWE doesn't do well better than they do, well, they're not getting the job done in the women's division, because AEW's women's division cannot even hold a candle, in my opinion, to Impact's, much less to WWE. So they've just got a lot of work to do to get it going. Now, it's a month in. There's only so much that we can take into account, and that does matter to this conversation. You can't analyze a company that's 4 weeks old in its television life to a company that's been around for the better part of 40 years on mainstream television and readily accessible to fans like myself in the United States. So it's not fair to nitpick AEW for every little thing they do wrong, because they haven't had a chance to do everything right yet. You know what I mean? You have to give them time to flesh all of this out. But through 1 month, if you want to do a fair analysis, I think that's a fair analysis. So one thing they're doing, by contrast, incredibly well is tag team wrestling. That was another thing referenced on last week's show that I would like to further emphasize now. Tag team wrestling in WWE has not had many golden eras. I've studied the WrestleMania era in and out, and there have been a few periods where it was incredible. It was incredible during the golden age of tag team wrestling, during the Hulkamania era, the Rock and Wrestling era, as it was commonly referred to, and universally is accepted in reference as the initial boom period in WWE's modern lore. They had another resurgence in the Attitude Era, toward the time when the card was getting beefed up, its roster being supplemented greater, when the company was making more money and was investing more in getting talents like Chris Jericho, Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, etc. It allowed guys in the tag team division to get a greater spotlight as the card needed to be filled out by more meaningful material. Edge and Christian, the Hardy Boys, the Dudley Boys, some of the other teams that rose to prominence during that period, really created a lot of great memories. The TLC era, as it has been fairly referred to as. Then you go through a really long drought outside of the brief period that was the SmackDown 6, and I hesitate to even include that, because really, when we talk about great tag team wrestling in the SmackDown 6 era in 2002, it was confined to the last few months of 2002. The tag team division sort of took a step back, and you had some good matches involving the likes of Team Angle. You got your rare gem like the Vengeance 03, Mysterio, Kidman versus the world's greatest tag team match. but you really didn't have a lot outside of that. Los Guerreros peaked in 2002, Angle and Benoit peaked in 2002, Rey Mysterio and Edge peaked in 2002, so we're talking about a brief period when tag team wrestling was an incredible addition to the show. There wasn't a consistency there beyond that, though, and there really wasn't a great consistency when you bring up the only other period of tag team wrestling in modern WWE lore that stands out, which is in 2017, when both Raw and SmackDown placed a greater emphasis on tag team wrestling through acts like The Bar, The Usos, a refreshed Usos, a refreshed The New Day, who was very much supplemented by that refreshed duo of the Usos, and you had the Hardys, and then you had the reformation of the Shield-ish, as I referred to it, Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins. So a lot of good stories involved tag team wrestling that year. A lot of great matches came of tag team wrestling that year. A lot of big tag team milestones, like the first Hell in a Cell tag team match involving non-main event acts and on a pay-per-view. You know, that was a big deal that year to have that kind of strength in tag team wrestling. But tag team wrestling as a whole in WWE has been largely absent for humongous portions of their life in the mainstream. Tag team wrestling deserves better. AEW is continuing what I feel is a renaissance in mainstream American tag team wrestling that was started by NXT. NXT's revival, pun intended, of tag team wrestling in 2015, 16, 17, and onward. It's been one of the best things about NXT as a brand, as they've been able to put the spotlight on tag team wrestling. But AEW is taking that to a different level. Part of that being that they have more teams. They have a lot of tag teams. They didn't even utilize two of their best tag teams in their tag team championship tournament. Santana and Ortiz beef up an incredibly stacked division already. They're doing a great job of elevating newer teams like Private Party, whose victory over the Young Bucks speaks to another big picture thing that AEW is doing right, which is they are pushing new stars. They are utilizing whatever platforms they have, be it via matches, be it via factions, that being competitive matches, by the way, like the Young Bucks and Private Party, be it via factions like Sammy Guevara is getting a nice push up through being associated with Jericho, as are Santana and Ortiz. You've got the opportunity for some good promo work, limited as it may be, giving someone like MJF the spotlight to be able to build himself up. These guys are building themselves to a really nice level, and I like the fact that they're placing an emphasis on taking young acts that people are not that familiar with and shooting them into the spotlight because AEW is going to need it. So you've got an incredibly stacked tag team division that week to week on this television show appears ready, willing, and able to give you excellent tag team wrestling, the likes of which in terms of consistency we've not seen in a long, long time, if ever, in a mainstream American wrestling promotion. So, WCW had a great tag team division at times too, particularly the one in the late 1980s. And the consistency of quality back then was fantastic, but we've not seen the modern equivalent to it, at least not over a longer period of time. I would like to see AEW build on what they've done through these first several months, because I think you take into account what they did on their various pay-per-views or free shows that they offered over the summer into account when having that discussion, and makes it clear that the pattern is going to be everything the Young Bucks said it was going to be. They are going to give you the best tag team division in the world. They're going to push it to the point where it can easily main event a show. You take a look at a match of the year candidate globally has to be the Young Bucks versus Lucha Brothers ladder match. And you combine all these elements and you've got a robust tag team division that can be counted upon to deliver every single week. And that's partly what makes it so exciting on Wednesday nights to tune in to AEW. Now, they've got to prove they can do that beyond the tournament, but I think they're already setting it up to where featured matches that aren't even for the tag team championships are going to be a part of their pay-per-views. There may not be a more interesting match on paper than the Young Bucks versus Santana and Ortiz that's taking place in a non-title situation, and what could best be described as no greater than the third biggest match on that show. That's a big deal to be putting a non-title tag team match in that situation. So it just goes to show they've got a heck of a division to utilize. It's from the tag team division that I also want to draw attention to another big picture thing that I think they're doing well, and that's utilizing tag team wrestling to build characters you can clearly see are going to be a very prominent part of the show and a bigger sort of singles atmosphere down the road. I look at Scorpio Sky from SCU. They did a very, and I think it seems very deliberate, and deliberate is a key piece of this conversation in the background, is it's not so much just about my buddy Samuel Plan, who wrote 101 WWE matches to see before you die, has this quote I'm quite fond of, that artistic achievement trumps authorial intent. So sometimes WWE has gotten things right in a tag team situation, but they haven't been able to sustain it, and you almost wonder if they're doing it deliberately. So deliberately, Scorpio Sky comes out and is very prominent on the stage doing a promo, very limited promo segment. So if you get one, it makes you seem like a big deal right now on AEW. And he comes out on the stage and says, hey, we're going to go with the veteran team of Daniels and Kazarian in the first round matchup we've got in this very important AEW tag team title tournament. So that sets him up as somebody who has his head on straight, who has a good head on his shoulders, who's concerned about the welfare of the team and the team's success. That sets you up to like Scorpio Sky. The following week, before their match with the Best Friends even happens in round one, the Lucha Brothers come out. They continue the feud that they started in week one with SCU, and they take out Christopher Daniels, which forces Scorpio Sky, who had, you know, sort of graciously bowed out, stepped aside to allow the more veteran tag team the chance to advance through at least round one, but now he steps into having to wrestle, and he's in street clothes. He doesn't have wrist tape on. He grabs wrist tape from the trainer's table, and he wrestles in a pair of slacks with his shirt off and an impromptu taping of the wrists on the ring apron while the tag team match gets underway. What an excellent touch, but what an excellent way to put the spotlight on Scorpio Sky and say very clearly to the audience, this guy is a big deal. He's also been in, he did that little Obama segment on the first episode where he did a very good impression of the former president. So they're presenting him as a guy with personality. They're presenting him as a likable team player, and they're presenting him as a gamer who can step in and help fill the gap exactly when needed to help SCU get the win in advance in the tag team tournament to face the Dark Order. So a very interesting sort of route to take, one that you feel is almost old school because you haven't seen it consistently enough. Those little details that from 1 week to the next week to the next week you pay attention to, and they add up over time. There's a book that I've read recently by James Clear called Atomic Habits, and one of the things that it discusses is how a lot of people want to see change take place in big chunks. So if you want to get 30% better, you want to go from 0% to 30% in a couple of weeks. But in reality, the way that most things change is we make a lot of little 1% changes at a time that add up to 30%. And that's the type of formula you see when you take a Scorpio Sky, you present him as somebody with personality in week one, and then you present him as somebody who's a team player in week two. You present him in week three as someone who can step into the spotlight and thrive immediately, and then things proliferate from there as week four sees SCU try to advance in the tag team tournament. Scorpio Sky all of a sudden looks like a big deal. You add up those little things over time, it's going to make him a potential breakout star. He certainly feels that way to me. And there are others, of course, on the show who are getting a great spotlight too. But that's a good example of the opportunity that I think AEW is affording its tag team division to present to the roster at large. There are a lot of players in this tag team division, and I'm excited to see week to week how it progresses. One thing that I think would help progression of characters being built is more promo time, and that's something that AEW thus far, I would say, could do a little bit better. It's sort of a New Japan-esque match after match after match type of dynamic on their weekly TV show to date, and that's fine. I mean, it's not like they're running into not having enough time Mostly, this is a show that's well-produced. Mrs. Doc, when she watched a bit of the first episode with me, made very clear that, hey, this looks like a legit thing. I mean, this doesn't look too far off the mark from what you see over on USA Network with Monday Night Raw, or now over on Fox with Friday Night SmackDown. AEW looks good. It looks really good. But I think that one of the things that is a lost art in pro wrestling is just giving a guy a microphone and letting them do what they let Chris Jericho do, knowing he's a veteran of that type of dynamic and is capable of going out and doing a 10-minute monologue and it not being boring and it feeling like it has emotional high points and emotional low points. So it's sort of in its own way, like what we see so often with in-ring storytelling, it verbally tells part of the story. And Chris Jericho was afforded that chance. Who else is going to get afforded that chance? Cody Rhodes has been afforded that chance. Can we get other opportunities for guys to have more to say? Jon Moxley is a guy who I thought within the first couple of weeks they would have handed him a live microphone and said, okay, you got 10 minutes. Go do whatever you want to do. Go say whatever you want to say. Try to build the Kenny Omega match. Make sure that people are fully clear on where you stand and what you're about that separates and differentiates yourself from what you used to be as Dean Ambrose in WWE, who many people felt was watered down. Now, again, caveat, it's only been 4 weeks for all we know. In week five and the show I'm going to with my daughter, they'll give they'll give Moxley that live microphone, let him go cut the equivalent of a pipe bomb promo that people will be talking about for months. That's not yet happened. It doesn't have to happen every week, but that's an example of something I would like to see more often. I would like to see on a weekly basis, frankly, somebody be given the spotlight to have a fairly lengthy talking segment. I would like to see feuds built up with lengthier talking segments. And a lot of these guys have never done it before, but that's okay. This is the infant stages of AEW's existence. Please, let's put them out there in that spotlight. And even if we criticize them, this is sort of a grace period for AEW. So I would like to see them take that chance. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Why not give a Kenny Omega the chance to do that? He hasn't done it yet. Now, they do the well-produced stuff, like the segment they produced in week three, I guess it was, on October 16th. With Cody Rhodes, I thought that was fantastic. I mentioned that on last week's show. I think that the production value of the types of videos that AEW puts together that they do on their Road 2 shows on YouTube, when they a lot of that type of content is as well produced by AEW as it is in any wrestling promotion, if not better already than any wrestling promotion. So there's another check mark in the things they're doing right box. But still, There is a part of the pro wrestling presentation as it has been. And maybe AEW takes a hard left with that, and that becomes a sparing thing that they don't overutilize. Because it certainly, if you're comparing it to WWE, it's overutilized. I think WWE does way too many live in-ring talking segments, most of which have nothing interesting to point out because it's all scripted and it changes so often that it doesn't tell a flowing story. If AEW can look at the alternative to that as maybe having one per week or even one every other week where somebody like a Jericho or a Cody gets to come out and engage a live audience and let us feel that and feel it through the television airwaves, I would love to see that because I think that is a part of the modern pro wrestling presentation that's an expectation. And to not do that, I think, leaves something on the table that is part of the visceral dynamic of pro wrestling. You get the visceral part when people go out and they tell their physical art, but the verbal part just takes it to a different level. CM Punk was one of the best at pointing that out to the wider audience. Is, hey, you can't take away what you can connect with people via what you say. There are things you can do with physicality, the body language, but you can't replace the verbal connection. And I would love to see WWE utilize that less, but right now I'd like to see AEW do it more and do it authentically, which is what you got to get to. It's got to be, here, here's what we're aiming at you going toward with what you say. But otherwise, you know, spend the day coming up with it, you know, rehearse it in your mind if you need to, but then go out there and just feel it and go with it and do it. And I think that's one of the best ways to build stars. And at right now, that's just an underutilized thing that they could be doing more. Now, that said, I think that they have given a minor spotlight to allow there to be what I feel is the development of roster positioning. That's something I've talked a lot about on this show in the past, as one of the primary things that WWE struggles with in the modern age. And I think in large part it's because they have placed so much emphasis on stars from the past that it muddies the roster positioning and how we're supposed to perceive the hierarchy for the guys that are around all the time. There's not enough consistency to the way they're booked for somebody to establish a position. An example I've always used, like that of Edge in the 2000s. I mean, Edge was one of the best positioned wrestlers of the last 8 years of that decade, quite frankly. Whether it was on SmackDown under Paul Heyman's tutelage before he broke his neck, whether it was 05 and onward. Edge was always a guy who you knew this guy was a big deal. You knew that he was a threat to be in the main event of WrestleMania. You knew that he was a guy who you should take seriously and that you should invest in because they taught you that's what you should do. So I think that the verbal dynamic certainly helps establish that hierarchy. But frankly, there are other ways to do it. And I think AEW is also, as we close out this part of the show today, they're doing that well. They're giving you a platform in many ways to really start to know these are the guys that are threats to win the world title. These are the guys who are going to be the major contenders for the world title. Now, here are the guys you should pay attention to that are coming up and are going to be important factors. And I also think that the tag team division strength helps here too, because, you know, you've got such strength in that tag team division's presentation thus far that any of the top level guys in the tag team division stepping into single stardom in the near future would be not only well received by the diehard fan base, but it would be something that made narrative sense too, because you would have had guys at that point that clear and obviously, like the Lucha Brothers, were big deals and very dangerous. So when you step Pentagon Jr. and Phoenix into the singles division, you're going to have a boon to that level of competition already established, I'm hoping, by the likes of Kenny Omega, Pac, Moxley, Jericho, Cody. I'm really excited about the way that things are shaping up there. I think you've clearly got, and this pay-per-view that's coming up Full Gear paints the picture well. You've got Cody and Jericho, a fascinating matchup really for the world title. I take back, as mentioned, a lot of the criticisms I had of Jericho in the beginning, presuming that this whole thing that he does, it doesn't last forever. But you've got Moxley. It's still going to take me a while, guys, with that one. Moxley with Pac, with Omega. You've got five guys right there that are clearly positioned, I think, as the top tier of the hierarchy in the AEW main event scene. And with only doing quarterly pay-per-views, you don't have to build so quickly and rush through all of the various challengers to the champions you're establishing as the faces of the brand. So roster positioning is something that I feel like right now they're doing well. The women's division maybe being the exception to that and needing a boost mainly in star power. So tell me what you think. Hit me up at the Doc LOP. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how you feel like AEW is doing thus far. Are they doing the big picture things right to you? Are they getting the little things right? Do you agree with me that they're doing that consistently? What are your criticisms? What do you think analytically is just something that they could do better? It doesn't have to be the WWE haterade type dynamic that is so prominent on the Twitterverse and wrestling Twitter and the wrestling media in general. Just give me something analytically that you're hoping they'll do better, as well as something that you think they're doing really well. I'd love to see that on social media. I think that's a good conversation and a fair conversation to have 1 month in, and then we'll reevaluate them as we get closer to the end of the year. One thing I'm curious to see how they do with, for instance, is when I'm there next week, it's going to be the go-home show. The go-home show for the pay-per-view. I miss go-home shows for pay-per-views. I always looked at them as one of the most exciting television shows to watch on the wrestling calendar because, particularly for big ones like SummerSlam, WrestleMania, they were that final jolt of excitement that fueled and hyped your enthusiasm for what you were about to witness. And I need to see WWE do that better, despite their new era of not having pay-per-view but having the subscription service. And I need to see AEW really take that ball and run with it in WWE's absence of it. That's a really fun TV show waiting to happen. I hope that they take full advantage of the classic go-home show format and really try to hard sell me on watching Full Gear, which I'm going to do anyway, to be honest. They've earned it, but I would love to see them make me feel that much more confident in my decision. Welcome back to the WWE Decade in Review series. This week we're going to be covering 2015. Now, coming out of 2014, one of the biggest stories was the rise to superstardom of Seth Rollins. Seth Rollins turns the corner to start 2015 and immediately takes it by storm. We're going to get to that and other big stories here in just a moment, but to conserve time and make sure I get you out of here at a reasonable time today, I want to actually talk about some of the stuff that usually is saved for the back end of these discussions. We'll get through those, and then we'll move into the big stories that defined the year and the wrestlers that defined the year. In terms of the mid-card, 2015 was an interesting year in the sense that it was dominated in many ways by John Cena's presence. That was the year where John Cena won the United States Championship and spent much of his time competing over the United States Championship. So there was a kind of an interesting dynamic in play there where you looked at what John Cena brought to the table. It was 2015 was his last really active year, and he spends most of it having television, barn burner type matches that many questioned in the past if he could even have. So when you try to have a conversation about the mid-card scene in 2015 and you're talking about one of the top five all-time greatest stars of the WrestleMania era, then it feels funny. And so it's almost just a weird conversation to have. And therefore, that's why I gave the mid-card Wrestler of the Year award to that year for Kevin Owens, despite the fact that he was only around for 6 months. In those 6 months, he was often feuding with John Cena, at least for the first few. That certainly prominently put him on the map when he showed up in the build-up to Elimination Chamber and then promptly defeated John Cena clean in the middle of the ring. That was a fascinating moment, but again, that skews you into is that really a mid-card situation? It's for a mid-card championship, ultimately, by the time they go toward the tail end of their feud, but it's again, you put John Cena in the mid-card conversation, it just doesn't feel right. But Kevin Owens would later go on to reinvigorate the Intercontinental Championship scene, and I really look at him as the guy who started the renaissance of the Intercontinental Championship. The renaissance of the Intercontinental Championship that up until recently had continued for probably its most consistent stretch in a long time. So Kevin Owens does get some credit for that, even though he had only started his run with the Intercontinental title toward the tail end of that year, and it wouldn't be until later on when he would factor more prominently into the division. So Kevin Owens is going to get the mid-card Wrestler of the Year award. His match with John Cena for the United States Championship, I guess, deserves the spot for mid-card match of the year, even though, again, I mean, it felt like a bigger piece of the hierarchical puzzle than that. So John Cena and Kevin Owens at Money in the Bank and Elimination Chamber were both non-championship matches. The one at Battleground, I believe it was the one for the U.S. title, and that almost by default gets the mid-card match of the year award. When you talk about underrated in 2015, again, I'm going to point something out that I feel, and I'm just going to mention this one thing as more of a thematic type deal than go through a lot of various different underrated situations and matches. Seth Rollins and his championship reign, he carried the title for 7 months. He was, to me, pretty unquestionably, for 17 months, the focal point star of WWE. And so it's sort of fascinating to me as we advance through this decade that Seth Rollins is not regarded in a higher position on the all-time hierarchy than he is. He's been around since, and prominently so, since the very end of 2012, so 7 years. He's only missed 7 months because of injury. He has been a prominent player and a fixture as one of the top two guys of his generation alongside Roman Reigns. And yet it doesn't feel like he gets credit for that. It doesn't feel like somebody with the kind of resume that he put together through the middle part of this decade especially is getting the kind of due that should come with that. And I think there are a lot of reasons why that might be, that might take better shape as we get further through this decade in review series and talk about the big picture stories and quote-unquote big picture problems that WWE has had as the decade has advanced. But you look back at people that had a similar type title reign with the quality of the matches that he had in 2015, opening up with the Royal Rumble triple threat with Cena and Lesnar that some regard as the best WWE match this decade and a new template to follow for triple threat matches. When you look at the quality of the match that he had with Randy Orton at WrestleMania, when you look at the kind of matches he had during his championship reign, many of which we will mention when we get to the match of the year section momentarily, for someone to have that kind of run, using the championship reign, of course, as the peak period of that, when there was no doubt anymore. You know, for months, he was the top guy. For 10 months prior, he was the number one guy featured on Monday Night Raw every single week. And when he wins the championship, it's nothing more really at that point than just cementing the status he had already built himself toward. He gets one of the biggest WrestleMania moments ever in cashing in Money in the Bank to beat Roman Reigns and remove the championship from around Brock Lesnar's waist. And he goes on and carries the title until his knee gives out and he has to forfeit the championship rather than lose it. And so you look back at that reign, and I feel like it's just an underrated period in WWE's modern lore, and certainly I think it's an underrated period historically. And so when you talk about Seth Rollins, and we seem to never be able to get over some of the narratives that have developed around him in the years since, but man, don't we need to be talking more as we advance through this decade about the run that Seth Rollins went on in 2014 and 2015? Match of the year. We'll run through this pretty quickly so we can spend the bulk of the remaining minutes on the top stories. Number 10 is Seth Rollins defending the title on Monday Night Raw against Neville, a classic television match that in its own right is underrated. Number 9, John Cena versus Seth Rollins for the WWE and United States Championships at SummerSlam. They had another really good one at Night of Champions the next month that was a little bit more mid-card style wrestled. But Cena versus Rollins at SummerSlam is one of the underrated summer classic gems of this decade. Number 8, recurring theme, Seth Rollins defending the WWE Championship against Dean Ambrose at the Elimination Chamber, the one where it looked like Ambrose had picked up the championship, but it ended up that it didn't work out that way in the end. They certainly did a good job of selling us on it. They would later revisit a comparable strategy in the match that he had, did Ambrose, with Triple H a year later at Roadblock. Excellent match, though. Really a fairly loaded match with underrated gems, or underrated, loaded year of underrated gems. Number 7, John Cena versus Kevin Owens at Money in the Bank. We talk about the Elimination Chamber match. We talk about the law of diminishing returns with this feud, like many of the feuds that John Cena had in that period of time. Rusev comes to mind. Bray Wyatt comes to mind. People that got a one-up on John Cena, but then were definitively told, well, you only get the one one-up, and in the end, Superman wins. LOL, as it was often said. Kevin Owens and John Cena, though, at Money in the Bank, they had a match that most people felt stole the show. Stole the show from a very controversial, yet in its own right, epic ladder match between Seth Rollins and Ambrose that we'll talk about in just a moment. Number six, Seth Rollins versus Randy Orton at WrestleMania 31. One of the best mid-card matches of the decade, as far as I am concerned. Something that, quite frankly, maybe we should put it ahead of Owens Cena when we have that conversation. I think the star ratings that most people gave were higher for Owens versus Cena. I even said that myself. But I think in terms of rewatchable mid-card classics on the WrestleMania stage, a category that includes such matches as Bret Hart versus Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 8 and Chris Jericho versus Christian at WrestleMania 20. These are three matches that I think are basically in the same category that deserve to be discussed together. And for Rollins and Orton to have accomplished that, to have accomplished a main event match in 12 minutes with that felt like one of the biggest matches on that show, from the video package to the way they executed it to the absolutely glorious finish with the emphatic RKO, one of the best RKOs, if not the best ever. Just a tremendous performance and one that deserves to be celebrated, perhaps more than it often is. Number five was Undertaker versus Brock Lesnar's Hell in a Cell match. They've had two historically. The fact that they've had two historically vaults them up the all-time list in terms of rivalries, in my opinion, because their Hell in a Cell matches both were special. And I think that the Taker-Brock Hell in a Cell match in 2015 is probably the best Hell in a Cell match that we had seen up until maybe the Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch one that just took place recently. Number four goes to Ambrose and Rollins at Money in the Bank. I mentioned a few minutes ago it was controversial, and the reason why it was controversial is because the crowd was so burned out from the Owens and Cena match. Owens and Cena is a match at Money in the Bank 2015 that was wrestled in a style that was designed to capture that instantly gratifying mindset that many pro wrestling fans have today around near falls. Ambrose and Rollins in a ladder match that borrowed from the principles taught originally by Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon, a story-driven version, perhaps on par only in modern lore with HBK and Jericho at No Mercy 2008. This was a tremendous ladder match. I've called it the Bret Owen in the cage at SummerSlam 94 of ladder matches. But going with that, that comes with a mixed bag of opinions. Some people felt like it was boring. It was certainly long. It certainly made winning the championship the focal point. It certainly was perhaps psychologically one of the best ladder matches ever. But you can't get away from the fact that the crowd's pretty quiet, and that there was a lot of backlash online. There was about an equal amount of praise as there was people thinking it was terrible, such is why I give it the comparison to Bret Owen in the cage at SummerSlam 94, because it got the same reaction and has been regarded for the last 25 years very similarly in cage match lore. Number three goes to John Cena versus Kevin Owens at Elimination Chamber. Crowd was hot. The people were loving it. The near falls were fantastic. John Cena takes a clean loss to a new star, debuting straight out of NXT. It's a special performance, no matter what happened afterwards and what your opinion of overkill might be. Number two is Seth Rollins versus Brock Lesnar versus John Cena. Yes, number two at the Royal Rumble, the triple threat match that some feel redefined the genre. I've not personally felt that way. I have been a proponent of this match being overrated. Nevertheless, I will not deny its quality, and I certainly will not deny that in the process that determines these rankings, that it scored very well in various metrics, from the pure elements to the historic nature of it to the very engaged crowd to the believability of the false finishes and plot twists in that match to just generally the format of it. It worked very well for what it was. But another triple threat actually jumped it. Perhaps controversially to me, the WWE proper match of the year in 2015 is Roman Reigns versus Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 31. Also including Seth Rollins in a cameo appearance that finished off the climax gloriously. The climax is something that I think helps it seize the day. Brock Lesnar, however, did give us the best version of the Beast Mode match against Roman Reigns that year. The blood, the fight that Roman Reigns put up, the general atmosphere of that particular WrestleMania. It was the last WrestleMania that clocked in at the traditional four-hour type mark, which it serves that show very well because that was an excellent WrestleMania. And so, you know, it's a match that's always going to have its critics, much like the ladder match involving Ambrose and Rollins. It's going to have its critics. The Beast Mode style is not for everybody, but it does tell, when it's done properly, an excellent story. And Roman Reigns basically proved that he belonged in that spot by his acting in that match, by how well he sold the beating that he took, and then how amazing it was to watch him come back when Brock busted himself open on the ring post. The fact that Rollins comes in at the end and gives you one of the all-time most iconic moments in WWE lore is just icing on the cake. So I would love to get your opinion on my choice for match of the year. But in terms of wrestler of the year, in terms of the big picture stories, one of the things that I felt needed to be discussed about 2015, albeit briefly because we're running out of time here, is the influence of NXT. NXT came to the forefront when WWE Network came to be in 2014, but we really didn't see that start to manifest as anything significant until 2015, because it was in 2015 by that point when we rounded the calendar that we'd seen Sasha Banks and Charlotte Flair have the best, perhaps, women's match in WWE history under their umbrella, overall umbrella, prominent overall umbrella. Their match at Our Evolution, the same show that gave us Sami Zayn versus Neville in one of the classic matches of 2014 that wasn't included in the WWE proper match of the year discussion on the last show, the Sasha Banks and Charlotte match was tremendous too. And when you round into the following year, 2015 establishes the women's revolution. It establishes the Four Horsewomen as major players moving forward in WWE lore. All four of them are huge players over the last half decade. You got Kevin Owens coming in and making a splash on the main roster. The Four Horsewomen minus Bayley show up on the main roster as part of the more sort of, I would call it, homogenized corporate version of the women's revolution and the conversation they tried to start, but in a way that felt less organic and hokey and certainly did not, until later, give the women the chance to be revolutionary. But Kevin Owens made the first real big main roster splash out of NXT. He comes in, and the work that he does is absolutely tremendous opposite John Cena. They have that rivalry that produced three Match of the Year candidates that my buddy Dave Fenichel has called, called back then at least, however controversially it might be, on par with Savage and Flair. Just a very big year for NXT, influencing the current product, and in a way that felt like WWE knew what they had in NXT and were going to treat the superstars who arose from it with a great deal of care and a great deal of respect. Although not always creatively firing on all cylinders, we saw what they would soon become by the end of 2015, particularly rounding into 2016. Charlotte, Sasha, Becky, Kevin Owens. I mean, these are big stars from the NXT system that made a huge splash on WWE's main roster product. That said, certainly I think the story of the year was Rollins. Certainly I think that Ambrose deserves attention there too because of just how much of a resiliency he showed. 2015 didn't start out that well for Dean Ambrose. He goes in and he's the only member of the Shield to kind of get downplayed during WrestleMania season. Obviously, I guess you could throw in the controversy at the same time with Daniel Bryan's comeback and ultimate retirement, but that's not something I feel like discussing right now. Let's keep it positive. Brock Lesnar peaked in 2015, a huge part of his legacy, and I think a lot of reason why WWE feels like they can't distance themselves from that formula is because in 2015, it worked incredibly well. John Cena's descent down the card, the last time we would see John Cena in a big-time pay-per-view main event, turned out to be in 2014. In 2015, he got into the United States Championship picture. He would have the odd big-profile title match with Seth Rollins that involved the WWE Championship at SummerSlam. But otherwise, John Cena was no longer the John Cena of old. He stepped into that mid-card role and had a period of his career that many look back upon as the finest and certainly one of the most critically acclaimed. But Seth Rollins was the story to me. I think that the way that he carried the company, as mentioned when discussing the underrated status of that period of his career and his overall bona fides, in part shaped by it, it's one of those dynamics, I think, that it's the most positive thing that came of that year. It was he was truly and really the number one guy on that show, and you may have had other stories like the failure of Roman Reigns to connect as a babyface like they wanted him to in the lead up to WrestleMania, in part because of the aforementioned Bryan dynamic that I don't want to discuss. There were some other things they didn't do particularly well with Reigns, and of course that ended up shaping a lot of the way things worked as we moved into 2016 and beyond. But celebratory mood, let's keep it there, and let's simply say that 2015 was a year that did some things right, but I think ultimately set the stage for what became 2016's worst things. And that is an unfortunate descent that you come to associate with 2015. For a while, it felt like WWE was ascending. 2014 was its peak. It started back down the mountain in 2015, but overall, still a rock-solid year. So thank you for joining me. I appreciate your time again on this longer show. It has been fun doing these longer shows the last couple of weeks, and it looks like we'll probably continue that for at least another week on this show, and I appreciate your time. I genuinely do. I know that there's a lot of content out there in the podcasting world for you to consume, and for anybody who makes this show a part of their life, it's pretty cool to me. So thank you. So everybody have a great week. I will let you go for now. Have an awesome week. Be well. Your next appointment on the doc says to fulfill your prescription, audio prescription for all things pro wrestling, will be next Sunday. So thank you for joining me again. Have a great week. Take care.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on radio. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast. Chat, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania.